This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week's episode features Alan Kronzig. He's a friend of mine who I often see from year to year at the 4F convention. He is a close-up worker, but he also does other stage things, and he's also a teacher. But his full-time job really has been as an author. And I say full-time because, golly, he's got a lot of things that he's doing, and he talks about a lot of these things here this week in this podcast. And I know you're going to learn a lot if you're thinking about teaching classes to groups. It doesn't matter if they're adults or children, but in particular, as for children, he has a book he recently published called Grandpa Magic, and he's going to talk a little bit about that towards the end of the podcast, but one of the things he has offered us is a copy of that book as a prize to some lucky listener. I'll tell you more details on the back of this podcast on how you can enter the contest, but let me just step out of the way and introduce our guest this week, Mr. Alan Kronzig, here on The Magic Word. Today, we have a lovely guest, a friend of mine I have known for many years, and we just don't get to spend enough time together. He is always working, and I get a chance at least annually to see him at the Effector's Finger Flicking Frolic out in New York. He's actually from New York, out in Long Island, and we'll talk about that a little bit then as well. He is also quite the creator. He has several books to his name, including Buried Treasure, Think of One, Texting the Visitor. Those are all instant downloads available over on Penguin. He's got Artful Deceptions, 52 Ways to Cheat at Poker. He has also a great little thing, I believe it's called Fate, which involves a coin and everything. And anyhow, he's just a very creative magician and mentalist. And we have a lot of really interesting things to talk about. But he just recently has completed a new book, which is called Grandpa Magic. And I think that that's pretty cool. And we'll be getting into to that then as well. So please welcome my friend, Mr. Alan Kronzig. Hey there, Alan.
Hey, Scott. Good to see you.
Good seeing you too, my friend. This is great. We are going to sometime soon be having the 50th anniversary of the 4F convention. I'm looking forward to that, which is going to be, I guess, in 2022, the way we're kind of looking at this then right now. And I know we've had that postponed in the past, but anyhow, that's something I always look forward to. How many years have you actually attended Effectors?
I've got a ballpark at 35.
I think you and I have been probably going about the same number of years.
You were at the Forks, right?
Yep, I was at the Forks. Yeah.
Yeah, that was where my first one was, at the Forks Hotel.
Do you remember who it was that was performing, one of your first ones?
Oh, I remember Dingle. I'm not sure that was my first, but Derek was there at the Forks. And Harry Lorraine, I think, was at the Forks, too. But I don't remember for sure who was the very first.
I just remember the last evening in which it was so much fun, and Paul Gertner was performing, and I think Al Goshman was performing. Gosh, I don't remember who the lineup was, but it was one of those memorable things that so memorable that I'd forgotten. It was like, holy cow, there's this guy and then that guy and then I got the guy. It was really, for my very first one, it was just amazing. Well, one I remember that Harry Lorraine had attended, I think Frank Garcia was there because Harry was lecturing one year. Do you remember that?
Yes, oh, for sure.
Yeah.
I remember the race for chairs, you know, somebody really special is lecturing.
Yes. And I remember being lucky to have a front row chair for his lecture, for Harry Lorraine's lecture. And I had a cassette recorder, which I set on the table right in front of him. He said it was okay to record. And the funny thing was, whenever that the thing stopped and it popped out, he just stopped mid-sentence and he looked at me and said, "I'll wait." And I pulled it out, turned it over, and he completed the rest of the sentence. I continued recording. And I ran through two cassette tapes, and he continued to go on to, like, I don't know, 2 a.m. or something.
Oh, I believe that, yeah. Because he still continues to go on.
He does. he is fantastic. And I wanted to ask you also, you live in Long Island, isn't that right?
Yeah, I'm in a little town called Sag Harbor, which is on the eastern end of Long Island. It's the unHampton part of the Hamptons.
the unHampton. Well, that was one of the things I was going to ask you about, certainly, because I remember a television show called Royal Pains that talked about this concierge doctor, and he was the doctor to go. Okay, you're familiar with the TV show.
I saw one or two episodes because it was locally related.
Okay. Did you kind of feel the same way that you were kind of a doctor of magic, I guess, to some of royalty? I mean, I assume that you performed a lot of those places.
It's very competitive out here in terms of who's performing. So sure, I did a lot of gigs. You know, I did a lot of private parties. I didn't do Steven Spielberg's party. You know, the real celebrities out here, when they bring out a magician that I've heard of, they bring out David Blaine, or they bring out, you know, another well-known name. Not that I haven't had a lot of work. I have, and it's been a lot of fun. But there are so many events out here and so many fundraisers, and the biggest attraction to any event is a celebrity, not a magician. And after they get all the celebrities that people want to see, then they'll bring in the magician or the mentalist or what other kind of performer they're going to have. So to answer your question, the main way I participated in the area during the season, which is the summer months, besides doing shows, is that I taught. You know, I taught privately, and I taught at a day camp, and continue to do that. So well, these were, you know, magic classes.
And for children of a certain age?
At the camp, it's A plus or 9 years plus. Mm-hmm. And they come every day for a week, and then I get a new crew. So they get 5 days of teaching, and they get a lot of apparatus and sleight of hand, and they get a book, and and they learn a bunch of cool tricks. And then by the end of the week, you know, those who really get into it and discover what it is, because a lot of kids sign up, oh, I want to do magic, I want to be a magician. And then when you say, okay, but you got to practice this. No, you know, you have to do this and go home and practice. And some kids come back the next day and they haven't done anything
right
the day before. And that's just the way it goes. But a good percentage of them really get into it. And that's, you know, that's very gratifying.
I suspect there are no magic shops per se in Sag Harbor or your area. They have to go into the city. The closest magic shop be Tannen's or something.
I think there's the one in Hicksville, New York, which is, I don't know, 70 miles from here.
I've been to Hicksville several times. Isn't that where Chris Angel was from?
That area, yeah.
Because I recall being out there and seeing, I thought, a photo of black and white. They had pictures, you know, hung up. It seems like that his picture was up there some years ago.
Sure, so. Sure. And there was a place called Ronjo's Magic and Costume in Port Jefferson. And maybe he still has magic, but the internet killed his business, you know, the walk-in business.
Most brick and mortars, yeah.
Yeah, and so the costume part was very important. But then he went into cannabinoids, you know, and oils and gummy bears and all that. So I haven't been to the shop recently, but that's at least half the shop is now that.
Well, that's interesting.
Maybe there's magic there too. I don't know.
Of a different type.
Yeah, a different type.
Exactly. Now, I want to get into talk about teaching a little bit. That's interesting. Are any of these students some who have attended, let's say, Tannen's Magic Camp, and then they come to your school, or vice versa, they go from there? You recommend them, or?
Nope. So far, no. They're just kids who have been interested in magic, and the parents hear about it, or one of the kids who's in a camp class shows a trick to a friend when they're over, and they say, oh, man, let's take some lessons.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's I've had kids over the years who have gone on to do things. I can't mention any names, but one of the a young kid from a very wealthy family came and studied with me and learned tricks and got really interested. And the next thing he was doing was an underwater escape in his swimming pool from a trunk that he bought someplace, you know.
Wow.
You know, and he had his own theater at home to perform in. So now it's fun.
That would be nice.
And I have some kids who just turned out to be really, really good, you know, when they get it and they are natural performers and you get to work with them. It's very satisfying.
Now you said it's a 5-day class or five classes, or how many classes?
Yeah, it's an hour and a half a day, 5 days in a row, and then I get a next crew. But some of the kids who were in that class will re-enroll again for the following week. And if there's room, they can come back for the second week, and then we start them on other stuff.
Oh, so you have like an advanced class for those who return?
Slightly more advanced. You know, I get them started in the first class on card stuff. Mm-hmm. And so those who come back, I'm mainly trying to push them in that direction because I have a limited budget in terms of the props that the kids can get. And you need props for 8 and 9 years old kids. You can't just do sleight of hand or card magic. You need a ball and vase or we do cups and balls with paper cups and little furry balls from the 5 and dime.
Right.
And, you know, if they come back the second week and they've learned their basic cups and balls, then we add some different moves. So it's when they return, it's adding on to existing material rather than showing them something brand new. Because when you do that, the other kids say, oh, what's that? I want that.
Right. Yeah. No.
So that's the way I handle it.
Where do you teach this? What venue do you use?
This is camp. This is a private camp.
I mean, is it outdoor kind of a camp?
It's a camp that really fits into this area. It's a camp for the overprivileged. Even though they have some scholarships, most of the kids there come from very well-off families. They go to private schools. They're very smart. What was your original question? Now I got off track about these.
I was asking what the venue was specifically, where they teach it. In other words, is it inside of a building or is it in a college or a junior college? Or
in the setup in this particular camp is that you have those who are going full days get a major and a minor. And a major is something like tennis or riding or sailing or golf. And they spend the morning doing that, or theater or band. Because there are lots and lots of options. And then in the afternoon, they do their minor. And one of the minors they can do is magic. They can do forensics. They can do weaving. They must have like 15 or 20 choices.
Wait a minute, forensics? Forensics? You mean like criminal forensics, like bones and things?
Detective stuff, yeah. You know, learn how to do fingerprints, learn how to... it's like a crime scene thing for kids. Very popular.
Holy cow.
Very
popular. Wow.
I'm sorry. We all go into this wonderful room for an hour and a half, and there are tables, and we're on the floor sometimes. And I usually ask for counselors who are interested in magic to come with these kids. So I get them learning the material, and it just everybody's. You know, there's a teaching segment, then everybody tries it, they practice it, then we come back, then somebody does it, then they're going to do it tomorrow, and they're going to have a little mini show. You know, that's the format.
Gotcha. Whenever I had taught a class, it was like a 6-week class at a local junior college, and so I had people, and they were adults mainly, of course, but there were children from ages 11 up to 81. So I had all ages, but mainly they were people who, let's say, were either students, college students already, or had started a career, or they were grandparents wanting to do something like grandpa magic or something, or some salesman wants to learn a trick or something like that. Right. In that case, I had taught them each week something different. So we would go the gamut completely from close up to stage to mentalism and escapes. We talked about ropes, you know, 1 week would be all ropes and 1 week would be all cards and coins. Another week we'd talk about escapes. Another week would be mentalism. We'd talk about, again, stage when we talked about presenting and the theory. Now, children wouldn't be so much into understanding theory. So I think it'd be difficult to try to explain that to them because they're just there to learn how to fool their friends back at school. That's the first thing everyone wants to learn is just a trick rather than the theory behind that. At what point do you teach them theory or do you really get into that much at all and explain to them why that trick fools them and talk about the psychology of that?
We get into that a little, and it really depends on the students. You know, if they can get it, then we talk about it. And if they can't get it, and you just do that. But interesting, my first book, which was a kid's book called The Secrets of Alcazar, and it was aimed at young readers. The way it was first put together, it looks like it's for little kids. I have a copy next to me. This is what the first edition looked like. So,
okay. Mm-hmm.
But it is a book that is filled with theory. Each chapter has a trick and then a piece about theory. Theory being what you say, theory of misdirection, theory of the subject of routining, how you pace yourself, how you sequence tricks. There are tricks for stage, there are close-up, there's parlor. So it's really an introduction to the scope of magic, the types of effects that can be done, and presentation. Presentation plays a huge part in the book. That's what people noticed and commented on at the very beginning, where you see a trick. In the first chapter, I teach the salt shaker through the table trick.
Okay.
It is performed in that chapter by the narrator of the, well, the teacher. Let me backtrack. The format of the book is that the author, me, is describing my studies with a master teacher named Alcazar. And I describe what Alcazar told me and taught me. And if there's any theory to be attributed to anyone, it's attributed to Alcazar. He taught me these things.
Uh-huh.
And so in the first chapter, Alcazar does the trick of salt shaker through the table, and he says magic words, and it goes through the table. And in chapter two, as we enter the chapter, suppose you don't want to act like Alcazar. That doesn't seem like a natural thing to do. Then we're shown how to take the same trick and make it be about something else entirely. You know, turn it into a science experiment.
Where, yeah.
Salt sprinkled on the table will make the coin go through, and then you sprinkle too much and the salt shaker goes through. So that's theory. And every chapter deals with theory in one way or another. And but I in truth, the market for that book did very well because it got terrific reviews, and school libraries bought it.
Why was that? I mean, there are other magic books all the time, of course, that libraries would have, but why did yours get resonate?
Because Library Journal and the trade magazine said, this is possibly the best one yet.
Wow.
In terms of an introduction to magic book, to magic. It's more than just tricks. It's, you know, it's theory, it's presentation, it's the whole scope of things. So it got really good reviews, and then they bought it.
Yeah.
But in truth, it's very difficult for a 9-year-old kid, if that's who picks up the book. It's too difficult for them. It's really a book for like 11 and 12. And when it got reviewed by Linking Ring and Magic Magazine, Michael Weber at the time, you know, it comments were this could be useful to adults too, because Alcazar had a lot of wise things to say.
And also it included science, you were saying as well. A little bit of science.
Only from a presentational point of view.
Oh, I see.
You know, that there are a lot of ways to present a trick, but it's not like the magic of science kind of thing.
Right. Do you teach mentalism then also in your class? And
it depends on what you mean by mentalism. sure. I mean, one of the
Equivoke or something, for an example, I assume.
No, I don't teach that.
Okay.
The closest I teach in mentalism is think stop, because one of the things that we learn in the card, when we do card magic, the first thing that kids learn is the key card.
And
by the end of the week, the kids can do 3 or 4 effects using the key card. And they learn different ways to have cards selected, different ways to have them put back, so it doesn't all look like the same thing. And then I do think stop for them, where somebody just takes a card, puts it back, and now we're going to turn them over. And when they see their card, they're to think stop. And I use a replacement that fools them, so they don't recognize a method they've already learned about putting a key card on top of a selection. So I use the same method, and most of the time they're just amazed at the trick. And then when I explained it, they, of course. That's a mentalism effect. And if they do that trick and that trick alone, they can fry somebody.
That's true. And have you seen some kids who go down a particular alley? They might think, okay, well, like the one you were talking about, the young man who was doing the escape act, for an example, he obviously picked up on that and liked it. Is there someone perhaps who likes cards that they would like that? Or maybe, as you said, with mentalism, that they kind of like that and they come, I kind of like that. Give me some more of that kind of a thing. Do you find they?
Yeah. More cards, more. Who wants more card tricks? Usually half the kids want more card tricks. The other kids want something new. So every day, what do you have for me? What's the apparatus? What's the new secret? Other kids are just interested in pursuing what they have and perfecting it. So a general rule. I mean, one of the most gratifying experiences I had was one of the kids who was in my class had a parent who worked at the school. And this was a Hispanic girl. A lot of the employees in the cafeteria are Hispanic, and they give scholarships to a number of the kids who go to whose parents work at the camp. So anyway, I had this girl who loved card magic, and her father was a chef at a restaurant at night and took her to work, and she took it upon herself to work the crowd. So she went table hopping, and she was really, really good. And she's like 8 years old.
Wow.
So that was fun.
Yes. Well, was that something then that she came back, and I assume she probably took that second week of class from you, the advanced class?
I think that's true.
Probably so.
Yeah. And I heard about that from other people on campus. They said, oh, do you know so-and-so? She showed us a trick. I said, yeah, of course I know her.
That's great. So it sounds like whenever you are asking them, so what do you want to talk about today? They want, when you say you like card tricks or whatever, you kind of teach a variety of things as opposed to having a syllabus saying, today we're going to do this, tomorrow is going to be something else, and we're going to continue to move on. So
there is a day-by-day syllabus, but I don't always stick to it,
depending
on what happens. But there's X amount of props that they're going to get. So, you know, it's like one every day they receive a new prop. So we have to get to that.
And in giving them the props, that's an interesting question. The reason I'm going into all this detail, there are so many people who do teach magic, and I think this is interesting. I have as well, and many others have or maybe want to. So that's why I'm trying to ask all these detailed questions. When you do have the props, do you introduce them? I think you kind of implied you do each day as opposed to giving them a box of stuff.
Oh, no, I do the effect. I do the effect first.
Okay.
You know, and it's a performance. So, and I have a variety of tricks that have all levels of skill. So, for one class, this is just coming to mind, I was very grateful to have the coin slide, you know, where we put in a nickel and it changes to a penny or a quarter or an empty. And I have several different routines you can do with a coin slide. You know, a wishing well think pattern is one idea where you have a penny and you put it in the wishing well and you wish you had a nickel and out comes a nickel and then you wish you had a dime or you wish you had your penny back. One of the story was just going to be that occasionally you have a kid who's a special needs kid and they just don't get a lot of the stuff. They just don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a trick that one such kid got and could do it. He could put in a penny and get the nickel. And boy, did I hear about that from the rest of the school, that he was so proud and he was showing it to so many people. And it was like very important to him that he was able to do this trick.
That's a great story because that way it empowered him basically and gave him a lot of self-esteem.
Exactly. So that's, you know, that's a trick that takes minimal handling. And another trick that takes a lot of handling It's marketed under many different names, but the effect is that you have a transparent cube with rubber bands around it and a little ball. And the effect is you can place the ball on a table and you just bang the thing down and the ball jumps into the transparent box. You know the effect?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So that's a great effect, but to get it out of the box and make it look natural and to display the props and set up in front of the audience, that takes work.
Mm-hmm.
And
to make it look natural, right?
Yeah, to make it look natural. So that's when you get in, when you asked about theory, that's when you get into a little bit of theory about what people notice and what they don't notice.
Direction and misdirection.
Direction and misdirection, what people will pay attention to, where you should look and why you should look there when you do certain actions. So if I'm able to do that, I love to talk about that. But, you know, if the level is on the, you push the slide in, then you turn it around and you push it in the other way, then that's the way that goes.
Yeah. Now, when you developed your program, did you then take this as a syllabus to the school, or did they come looking for you? How did it actually develop?
I said, we need props. And
I don't mean as far as taking it to the school, or I mean to the camp to begin with. How did you get involved with the camp?
They came to me.
Okay.
Somebody said, I met somebody in the camp and somebody said, oh, you want to have a magic class? And they said, oh, Alan, you interested in teaching a magic class? You know, yes, I am. Okay.
Yeah.
Come on by, let's talk about it. Then we talk. And then I had to think about it. I asked some people, you know, who do magic at camps. Brad Henderson was one, and mm-hmm. Oscar Munoz. Oscar was the one who said to me, props, you got to get props. Don't teach them sleight of hand if they're 8 or 9 years old. So I got some good advice, and then I went to the camp people and told them what I wanted to do, and they wanted to know, well, we buy all the props and because we get a discount because we're an educational organization. But basically I said, okay, but you're going to buy them through Robbins. This is where you're going to end up. Mm-hmm. And they said, what do you want? And I go to Robbins and I see what they have and give them this is what it's going to cost. And it breaks down to X per student. And they say, yes.
Gotcha.
So that's what happened.
Yeah, I've had, whenever I had taken my syllabus to the college, and I was working both at Midland College and Odessa, their junior colleges. And when I'd taken that in then to begin with, they said, this is the first time that a teacher has gone to this much detail. They just usually pitch us an idea, but you've come already prepared with all of these ideas, this outline, the books they're going to be doing, and you're good to go. But the point is, I was able then to sell the books and make some more profit, basically, on that. I didn't have props. Again, I wasn't teaching children. I was teaching adults, young adults, older adults. And so they were assigned a book, and I just happened to have the books available, just like, again, at a college, you're supposed to go to the bookstore and buy the books. Well, you can't buy these books except through me. So it's a little bit different, I guess. And so I'm just, again, saying this for those who are interested, if you're teaching adults as opposed to teaching youth as you had, because I had some rope that I would cut and give to them when we would come back the next week, because we're going to be talking about rope. So, and here's the reading assignment to learn some tricks, come back the next week and do that, which is another thing. Did you assign something? So each day when you were saying, sometimes they did come back and do something, and other times like, oh, I didn't do anything. So how did you go about your assignments?
To, you know, hopefully go ahead and practice and, you know, then, and they're eager to show it. So we usually start out every class by saying, okay, any questions? Next. Anybody show any of the stuff we learned yesterday? Then they all comment on what they showed and what happened. You know, and what happens is, you know, grandma applauded and it went well, or my brother grabbed it out of my hand and I couldn't finish, you know, or my parents said they saw what happened, or I fooled them. And those who had a unsuccessful experience, I try to figure out what happened and correct the problem if there is something that they missed or they're not doing right. And you know, that's how we start with a review. And then we learn a new trick, and then we have a time at the end for anybody who wants to perform something that we've already learned or something they learned on their own. Then we do that for the last 20 minutes.
When you say the students are anxious to demonstrate and to show what they have learned, I would think not all students are that way. In other words, there are introverts, and that's part of what magic does, is it helps to give you confidence and to be more of an extrovert. I assume you are seeing some who are not as extroverted in your class develop over the even short period of time to become more entertainers. Would that be fair?
It would be fair to say that I've seen that happen. I don't think it's the general thing, the general rule.
So generally they are extroverts to begin with.
Yeah. Okay. Many are. Remember I said they come from privileged homes.
That's what I was about to say, because of their background, they probably feel they can do anything.
Yeah. Many of them do, but there are exceptions. You know, there are kids with special needs or kids. There are introverts, certainly. There are people who are not very smart, but don't quite know how to communicate. I had a really quirky kid who came back year after year. I'll just tell you his idea. One of the tricks I teach that we teach is the Buddha papers.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the presentation. And this is something you can buy for Robbins. I forget how much they are. It's like $2 for seven or 10 of them in a pack. So it's a really cheap trick. And it's a good trick. And, you know, they sell it as a money exchanger. You put in a nickel and you have a dollar come out or something. And I do it as it's called the Chamber of Secrets. And because there's one secret wrapped inside another. And I bring in a leaf that I picked from outside, and we cut the leaf into pieces and put it into the chamber and do this ritual and put a rock on top of it and do a bunch of presentation, and you open it up and the leaf is restored. So it's nice. And I had this kid come in with his own version that this was a cloning machine.
Okay.
And his idea was that he tried is you catch and put an ant in the paper.
Okay.
And you wrap it up, and when you open it, you have two ants.
An aunt and an uncle. Okay.
Well, nobody ever thought of that before. That's a good one. You know?
Yeah.
It's a good effect. You can make it into a stage effect, you know, somehow.
Well, I recall one of the
quirky kid.
Yeah, I had some students when I taught Professor's Nightmare. And I said, come back then next week with your own presentation. I'll be brief about this, but everybody did completely. One person was like a car salesman. So he talked about, I got these three different kinds of cars, or it's going to be an economy car, midsize, and a luxury car, but they're all going to be on sale for the same price. And then, that sale will go off tomorrow or whatever, or someone was going fishing and they wanted to catch these different size, you know, small, medium, or large fish, but they use the same size of worm to catch these different fish, size fish. And then yet another lady who was a belly dancer actually did it to mime, basically, and she had the ropes in her, tucked in her gown or whatever, or belt, I guess, and some scissors, and she would dance over to someone. She was using his timbales or whatever. Then the guy took a rope, and she took him back from him, and then did the Professor's Nightmare, and they put him back. It was completely different, obviously, but completely no speaking part or anything, but something, a different presentation than I had ever seen before or since. But the point is, just like that child, using one ant to two ants, I think that's just showing some real creativity there.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree.
Yeah.
I pass that along to other students.
That's a good idea. So I was going to ask you also about many of the books that you have written and getting involved in that. How did you, the first book you had shown us there a moment ago, how did you go about writing that and publishing that? Did you have a publisher that you had gone to? Did you write it with that idea of publishing? And of course, what year was that when you published that first one? 80s?
Let me look. I think it's, what does it say? 1980.
1980. Okay. A lot different back then because we really didn't have the desktop publishing that developed later. And so you really had to type it out on some, I guess, some paper and take it into the printer. So what was that like and how did you decide to, or why did you decide to publish?
I had recently moved to this area and one of the people I met and became friends with was a literary agent. And when they discovered I was interested in magic and was doing some magic, she suggested that I write some articles for Cricket Magazine, which is a kids magazine.
Oh, sure.
A series on how to do magic. And I said, sure. And I dreamed up this teacher, Alcazar, who was going to be the one who passes down all the knowledge about magic. And that was a great idea, I must say, because it takes all the burden off giving myself the credit for the expertise and just attributing it all to Alcazar. So I did a few of those, and then it became clear that there could be a book there. Hmm. And the very same literary agent pitched the book, and we sold it. It was Macmillan that had a press called Four Winds Press, which was a kids' press, and they bought it and gave me an advance, and I wrote it, and they chose the illustrator, and I posed for the photographs, and it was illustrated in a style thought to be appropriate for young kids. And that was the first book. And as I said, it got great reviews. It got reviewed in Scientific American, which was very, you know, always interested in magic via Martin Gardner. Mm-hmm. So, and they gave it a rave review. And so did the other mags. The only one who thought it wasn't really appropriate for kids, for young kids, and said so was T.A. Waters in his review. And he was right, you know. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's how that first book came across, came to be written. And around the same time, I had been juggling various things to do for a living. I was studying music. I had been, after graduating college, I was a writer, a freelance writer. I wrote all kinds of nonsense book jacket copy and music reviews. I wrote for a music magazine. I wrote for Downbeat magazine. I wrote tabloid trash for a number of years, just making up stories. So, you know, I was making a living as a writer. And now I had a successful book, and I thought, oh, well, okay. Here's something I can write about. And so I wrote some more and eventually wrote a book with my daughter that became a New York Times bestseller, which was a guide to the magical world of Harry Potter called The Sorcerer's Companion, which came out in 3 editions. And
did you have to get approval from the,
J.K. Rowling?
Yeah, from Rowling?
No. Okay. And the reason was because I didn't really appropriate anything from her. The book was going to be a reader's guide to Harry Potter, a companion book. When I was working on a different book at the time, which was going to be a history of magic, as a performing art for middle schools. Mm-hmm. So I was working on that. And also it was going to incorporate a history of magical beliefs about magic and magic ideas. And I thought at the time, Harry Potter suddenly was very, very popular all over the place. And I thought, well, why not see what's there? Maybe I can include some stuff about Harry Potter. And I read the books and noticed that, holy smokes, there's a lot of stuff in these books, references that I know about, having read about all kinds of magic since I was a kid, including in anthropology and history of actual magical beliefs that the readers of the Harry Potter books don't know about. And the book I had been working on, which would also talk about spells and potions and these magical things, that's all in the Harry Potter books. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, why not a history of magic seen through the Harry Potter books? So that's what came. When I say history of magic, I'm not talking about the, you know, fairy tale magic.
Not necessarily about Robert Houdin or anything like that. You're talking about like Merlin. Okay.
Yeah. There happens to be an entry on magic as a performing art, you know, in the chapter on magician. What is a magician? Uh-huh. There are many concepts of magician, from a shaman to a village wizard, to a guy who conjures spirits in their room, to the stage performer. So those are all considered,
you know, right,
and given billing in the book.
Now, you're talking obviously a market for the general public with these books, as opposed to the books you've also done for magicians. And so I'm assuming that you had a much larger public, or more printing, more copies printed of those books for the public than you did for the general public.
Sure. Yeah. No, there were large printings of all the books, I'm happy to say.
Right. How many reprints did they do of the Potter book or any other those other books?
They did three editions of the Potter books as more Potter books came out. First book came out, there was one movie and four books.
Mm-hmm.
And then we waited two more books and brought out the second edition that had entries about the two new books. And then we waited till the final book was done, book seven, and then brought out a third edition. And I lost track of how many printings they went through.
Because there's so much material, I assume, that can be added to that as they progressed in life.
Yeah. You know, there's, well, I mean, there would be more magical practices added to the later books that she hadn't mentioned earlier. Or for example, the idea of the Horcrux, this thing that you keep your soul in.
Yes.
That wasn't in the earlier books, and that took some research to figure out where that came from and what the precedents are in fairy tales and in other cultures, you know, for that.
That probably had to be a whole complete chapter.
Yeah, well, it's an entry. These are all like short encyclopedia length entries on the subject at hand.
Ah, I understand.
I was going to say we really sold it at first in doing the pitch. First of all, we couldn't, you asked about J.K. Rowling. A couple of agents, when I was looking for an agent to agent the book, said, no, I'm not going to touch this because this could be infringement. And we definitely didn't want to do infringement.
She had more money than anybody. She could take anybody to court forever.
She did. She took one of the people who created a fan base.
Really?
A fan site who she was perfectly fine with until he decided to put out a book. And what was in the book was just essentially a recap of the plots and what happened.
Oh, that's not cool.
She put him on, took him to court. Mm-hmm. And the trial was in New York City. And during the trial, my book is given to her on the stand. And she is asked, are you familiar with this book? And she says, yes, I am. And do you have any problem with it? And she said, no, I don't. Hmm. No, this is not taking from my work. It is enlightening the reader about the history, the background, the mythology, and the folklore behind all of these things. So I'm just fine with it. So
that's quite an endorsement, actually.
Yeah, we didn't use it as an endorsement, but we could have. we did. But I guess what I was saying is what sold the book in the pitch were some sample entries about some of the practices, like Hermione in the second book is really interested in arithmancy and talks about it a lot. But mm-hmm. most people had no idea what this is. So we wrote an entry on arithmancy, which is really numerology, and what system might be taught at Hogwarts using an actual system, you know, from the Middle Ages. and how to do it. And, you know, so that was of great interest to the agents who were reading the book and had to pitch it. And there's a chapter on Nicholas Flamel, who was in the first book, who was the one who invented the Sorcerer's Stone. And most readers of the Potter books had no idea that he was, you know, an actual person who actually lived. So there's a legend of Flamel. So we put that in the pitch. And when they got the pitch, a particular agent who was highly recommended immediately put the book up for auction, which is something a publisher only does when they think they have something special. Because otherwise, you do not send a manuscript to multiple publishers at the same time, because you might run into the situation where somebody says, oh, I want that. And you say, oh, I'm sorry, you're late. We sold it. So you don't do that. But
you have to have an agent.
Say again?
You have to have an agent.
It helps if you want to have somebody look at it. You know, if you have an agent with a name, sure. So this agent said, we're having an auction. Here's the book. Here's the chapters. Give us your best offer. So she sold it rather quickly. From the time we submitted the chapters and the outline and the table of contents for the whole book, it was sold within a month.
Wow. So how long did it take then for all of the background and research that you had done for that? Because it sounds like obviously it had taken a long time for Rowling to have written the book, but then for you to do the research about those things, you have to read the book and then go back and look into all those kinds of things and alphabetize and then put them in an encyclopedic kind of a format, like you were saying.
Yeah. Well, we did it. I wrote the book with my daughter, who was at that time just had earned her master's in history at Princeton and was working on PhD stuff. And we decided to do it together because she has a background in history. I have a background in magic. So from the as I said, we got the contract on the fourth book, and they wanted that book out when the first movie came out, which was Christmas. And so we had to get the book out in a year.
Wow.
So the two of us pretty much worked 12 or 14 hours a day for a year. And we got another person, a college friend of my daughter's, to be in charge of gathering the illustrations. And just we worked our asses off.
Wow.
That's how long it took.
That's kind what it sounds like.
Crazy, crazy year.
Going in a little bit different direction, I wanted to ask you also about, and I can't remember the name of the trick right now, then Alan, but was it Fate, the one with the coin?
Destiny, Chance, and Free Will.
Destiny, Chance has nothing to do with Fate. Destiny, no. Chance, and Free Will. Okay. Can you explain that effect? I think that's a beautiful thing.
Well, the premise is the when I'm performing, I usually say, this is the most philosophical piece I'm going to do for you. And it has to do with three things. The idea of destiny, that things are fated to happen as they do. Chance, randomness, and free will. And the effect is a card effect in which all of those things are put into play. For the concept of destiny, I bring out what is called the coin of destiny, which is an intriguing looking coin, and it is placed on the table and it stays there throughout the rest of the presentation till we get to the good parts. Chance is demonstrated by taking a deck of cards and shuffling it. And the spectator gives it a genuine shuffle. And we ask the question, do you think these cards are now arranged by chance or that they were destined to be in this order at this time? And you get different answers. Some people say chance, some people say fate. We move on to free will, where by their own free will, they choose a playing card, they remember it, they put it back in the deck, they shuffle, chance or free will, they decide what they think is happening. At any rate, we now take the deck of cards and divide it into four packets. They take the coin of destiny in their hand, they place it on the packet that they believe, or that fate is leading them to believe, contains their card. We get rid of the others, and eventually you narrow it down to one card. And all of their choices about where to put this coin and which packets and which cards to eliminate are all genuine free choices. And when they are finished, they indeed have found the card that they chose. It ends up under that coin and in more ways than one. So that's the basic premise.
That's a beautiful thing. I bought that from you many years ago. I don't know why I haven't dug that out and play with that more often. Is that one of the, your go-to things you perform all the time?
Absolutely. It's it's a killer. It's a killer. And, you know, the reasons it's a killer is that the spectator does everything. You know, they shuffle the cards. They pick the card. They put the card back. They shuffle the cards. They choose the packets. They put the coin on the packets. So there's just a huge amount of participation, which for me is essential in doing the kind of magic I like to do. Close-up
magic, card magic. Did you develop that one? Is that based on something else, or were you talking about some other mentalists?
It's based on an Eddie Fields routine originally called Dropsy Diddle. The concept, the Eddie Fields part being that on the bottom of a coin is an image of a playing card. Mm-hmm. And eventually that card gets placed on a selection.
The coin gets placed on the coin.
And you can now claim that the card is under the coin. And you flip the coin over and there is an image of a card, which is the card that they have selected through a force. And then, but I didn't know the Eddie Fields routine. I learned it from Card College. And I think it's called the Lucky Coin in Card College. And I performed it every once in a while. And I don't really rightly remember how it transformed into Destiny, Chance, and Free Will. But I think it just kind of became natural because the outcome is destined. There is the element of chance of having them shuffle the deck and freely choose a card. So eventually, and I did it for a long time. I had a great gig in a wonderful, very cool club in this area called the Wild Rose Cafe, now defunct. But for years, I was there every Thursday night from like 8 p.m. till 1 a.m. Doing close-up.
Wow.
You know, at the bar and at tables between sets when the band was on for dancing, which is a great dancing joint. So it was just the best gig you could ask for. And that's where I developed a lot of material because I could do the same thing again and again, you know, 5, 6, 7, 10 times a night.
I would think that would be a pretty loud venue to perform.
It was.
So with the bar. So there are some things I assume you developed that were not dependent upon them paying close attention to what you're saying, but just watching?
Yeah. I would start out usually... the band didn't start, you know, until 10, and I would show up at 8. And so there would be people at the bar at 8, and there would be people eating as well. So I would do those people, and there was no band. And then when the band started, you know, I worked where I could, at the bar, one-on-one. The point was just to have fun. You know, I didn't have to please the management that I was, you know, earning my keep. I just had to please somebody.
I don't think I've known of anybody else who has worked a restaurant for a 5-hour shift.
Well, that's just because I was dancing between times and having fun, and my wife would come down and friends would hang out. So it was just a very cool place to spend time.
I mean, I worked 2 to 4 hours, but never 5 hours. I mean, it's like almost a full day shift, it seems like.
But I, you know, for me, it wasn't a job. It was a playground. Mm-hmm. I can stay on a playground for
and a test. Yeah, well, that's a good point because you are playing. You're having a lot of fun. You're learning. They're learning. Rather, you're using them to test out some new material and everything. So, as we start to wrap up over here, I was going to ask you: do you like mentalism a little bit more? I mean, that sounds like a mental effect as opposed to a card trick. Would you say that's fair, or would you?
I'm not sure that Destiny, Chance, and Free Will is a mental effect. Mm. It's deeply mysterious.
Yeah.
To the spectator, you know, there just is no explanation. And sometimes, you know, it has two endings. One ending is that the card they selected really is under the coin, and they've really genuinely eliminated all the cards but one.
Yes.
In which case you don't do the reveal of the card under the coin.
Mm-hmm.
This is just an inexplicable routine. There's just no way to understand how this could possibly have happened. Yeah. I like those kind of routines. But I wouldn't call it mentalism. And I don't do much mentalism. The one trick that was a big hit for Penguin is mentalism. It was called Think of One. And in the essence of that trick is you think of any card, genuinely think of any card, and with very little procedure, and no more than two wrong fishes, and rarely any wrong fishes, you know what the card is.
And it's a borrowed shuffle deck.
Yes, borrowed shuffle deck.
Mm-hmm.
You get there very quickly. So that got up a lot of attention. Penguin put it up for their Download of the Year award, which it didn't win. But it was very popular, a lot of comments, and a system of discovering a thought of card that apparently nobody else had figured out.
Yeah.
So
interesting. Yeah. If people are interested in wanting to purchase anything of yours, or let's say the chance.
Destiny, Chance, and Free Will.
Where can they go and find that? Is it Alan Kronzig?
It was in my book, Artful Deceptions, which is a book of, do I have it? Of my card stuff, which Vanishing Ink published. Ta-da.
Oh, so you know, I think I've got a copy of that. Didn't you have that at the Fectors a while back?
I did.
Yeah, I think I might have gotten one from you back then.
Well, it's in there, but it sold out. But Andy Gladman tells me they're going to reprint, most likely at the end of the year. So that'll be available again. The things I did for Penguin, three things, are all in the book, but the book isn't available, but the downloads still are. So you can learn Think of One from the downloads. Texting the Visitor, which is really Larry Jennings' effect, Visitor, but updated, very nice handling, and a theme that makes sense, and a trick called Buried Treasure. And just let me get in a plug then for Grandpa Magic.
Oh, yep, didn't even get to that. Sorry, because that's your newest book.
My newest book is Grandpa Magic.
That was where I was going ultimately. Sorry. Yes, thank you for pulling that up.
And so this was for grandparents and suggesting this is a way to relate to the grandkids, you know, especially if you only see them on rare occasions. This is how to get them off of their phones. This is how to engage them. And that book was published by Workman. It's beautifully illustrated, very, very friendly, easy to learn, good material.
And about 114 tricks or something like that?
They're not all tricks. There's brain teasers and stunts and, napkin animals you can make and how to make a spoon cry. Just stunts that you can pull out when appropriate and when is it not appropriate and do for the grandkids.
And that's on Amazon.com? I can get that also?
Yes. Yeah, it's on Amazon and Walmart and, any place else you want to go for it. And the last thing I might as well mention, it's coming up to 13 years since I wrote 52 Ways to Cheat at Poker. And I've been working on a little retrospective essay about what it was like to write that book and what I expected of it that I'm going to put out shortly. Since I finished writing it, find a place to post it.
That sounds great. Well, listen, as we do wrap up, I want to thank you very much for your time, Alan. It's always a pleasure to see you, as I said, get a chance to chat with you, particularly at least annually when we get together. And I do come out to New York for 4F convention. Seems like the only time we get together. I think, do you attend the Magic Live conventions in Vegas? Have I seen you out there?
I've been to some, and I'm...
Yeah, I think I'm...
They're pitching one for this year, I think.
Yeah, there's supposed to be one, I think, in August here of 21.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I'm registered for that. And just before that should be the Collectors Convention, which I'm registered for. It's been sold out for a while then, too, which part of the advantage of that is on the Collectors that Copperfield is going to give all of the registrants a private tour of his museum. That's going to be kind of cool.
Oh, yeah. Very cool. Yeah,
that's why it's been sold out for a while.
Love that.
So listen, as I said, as we close, I always like to ask my guests what it is. It's their magic word. What is it? Your philosophy of life? So it could be a word, a phrase. What is it that's important in your life?
Oh, man, you should have warned me about this.
Yeah. It's inherent in the title of my podcast, Magic Word Podcast. Yes.
Honesty.
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 Be honest. As a magician, it's hard to be because we're supposed to lie and cheat people in a way, and in a fun way. So...
Well, this is coming to me at the moment because I happen to be coaching somebody. This particular person is having difficulty. I have difficulty trying to pass off presentations that are bullshit, as if they're real. For example, it's well known that we only use 10% of our brains. But I'm going to show you how I use the other. That's not true that we only use 10% of our brains.
But that's what they say.
You know, we use all of our
brains. All of our brains, yeah.
And I'm trying to get this person to develop presentations that have something to do with his real self rather than a made-up persona. And, you know, I don't have a persona, a performing persona, that's my stage identity. When I perform, I'm performing as me. And when I'm writing my books, I'm performing as me.
So you're the same on and off stage, basically.
Except that on stage, I'm much more animated.
That's the way you should be. I think you are a bigger person on stage of your actual self.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I mean by honesty. You know, in the presentation of magic, I don't pretend this is real magic, but I do pretend that mystery is fun, you know, and that's not pretending, actually.
I like that. Mystery is fun, and it's not pretending.
That's my word of the day, honesty.
Honesty, love it. Well, Alan, thank you so very much. You've been a wonderful guest and a wonderful friend. Thank you. Wish you the best.
Thank you.
Good luck with Grandpa Magic and your other publications then as well, and also with classes. And so until next time, that was Alan Kronczyk. This is Scotty out.
Absolutely delightful. Thank you so very much, Alan, for being my guest here this week and for sharing all that information. It was interesting to learn a little bit about publishing as well as certainly about teaching. Having been a teacher myself for many years in different places, a lot of good information, and I think anyone else who might be interested in wanting to publish their own books or to maybe offer classes, you've got some good instructions there. Well, I also thank you very much for writing the book, Grandpa Magic, and in particular for offering a copy of that to one lucky listener. If you just go to this week's episode, which is number 607 at themagicwordpodcast.com, there you will find a form you can complete putting in your name, your email address, and then it will go automatically into a spreadsheet, and then in a couple weeks we will randomly select a winner, and the person who is the winner will be sent a copy of this book. Domestic shipping is free. However, if you live outside of the U.S., you can still enter, but the shipping charges to foreign destinations will be calculated, and you have the option then of deciding whether or not you want to reimburse Alan Kronczyk for that shipping. And if not, then we will move on, and then another random name will be selected. Anyhow, you get the general idea. We thank you very much again for entering the contest, and I know you're going to enjoy this book as well. It has well over 100 tricks that are in the book.
I also want to remind you about another contest which is running concurrently with this book, and that is The Magic Graveyard by Al the Only. We started running that last week, and we're going to continue that for another week. So again, there are two contests that are overlapping each other. One is for the Grandpa Magic Book, and the other is for The Magic Graveyard. You may certainly enter both of those. Those are two separate forms, which you'll find on this week's blog. So just go there and fill out either or both, whichever you prefer. Again, domestic shipping applies as well for free for The Magic Graveyard as well as The Grandpa Magic Book. One other big favor I'd like to ask everyone who is an iTunes user, if you could go to the iTunes store and just leave us a 5-star review. If you can't leave 5 stars, then don't leave anything at all. But it's either 5 stars or nothing. 4 stars doesn't do us any good. So we'd like to also read a comment that you have that would be favorable. If you enjoy this podcast, please give us 5 stars and leave just a few words of encouragement. That helps the podcast grow, lets other people know about this as well, and moves us on up in the rankings. And so, until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to be honest, because mystery is fun. This is Scotty out.